the Dinat brought our coffee in honor of, and request that today's shir be dedicated to the Yortzeit and to the Lui Neshama of her father, Mordechai ben Asher Zelig. And of course, our learning should be in his memory, and a schus from the Neshama, and he continue to be a Meretz Yosher for all of Klal Yisrael. Brings us to Perek Tet. We start a new Perek today. And we're missing a few. Oh, there we go. I was about to say, where's we? Okay.
We're just starting.
Coffee is available, and it even has the half and half to go with it. The letter on letterhead, they still need that?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I wasn't sure if that call off the dogs meant me too.
Yeah.
Did I get the call off the dog? I got the first email.
I'll be happy to take care of that this morning. Do you have a fax number? Yeah, I don't have a fax number.
So when is the interview today?
I wonder
he's on the phone with Israel.
Okay, folks, let's go. Our time is short, and it's getting shorter. Vayhi, Perek Tet. Perek Tet. Vayhi chishmoa kol hamelachim asher be'ever hayarden bahar ubashvela ubechol chof hayam hagadol el mul ha-Lebanon. החיתי והאמורי, הכנני, הפריזי, החיבי והיבוסי. It was. ויהי, it was. כשמוע כל המלאכים, and all of the kings, אשר בעבר הירדן, all of the kings west of the Yarden. Who are the kings west of the Yarden? Every city is a king. Remember that we're dealing with city-states. So every city has its king. So Eber Yarden is west of the Yarden. Every city has its own king. So all of the kings, Asher be'Eber HaYarden, and now, geographically, Bahar u'Bashvila, mountain, plain, u'V'chol Chof HaYam, coast. If you split Israel geographically, vertically, there are essentially four geographic areas vertically in this tiny little speck of land. The Jordan Valley, the mountain ridge of Hare Yehuda and Hare Shamron, the Shvela, which is the plain, the flat land just west of the mountains. If you leave Yerushalayim, you go out Shar Hagai, you get this big open space, and that's called the Shvela. And then the coast, Chof Hayam. And there are four different indigenous populations who live in each of those regions. So we divide Israel vertically, you get Har, Shvela, Chof Hayam. I left out the valley, but essentially it's the same thing. Uvachol Chof Hayam Hagadol. The coast of the Great Sea, this is called the Yam HaGadol. El Mul HaLevanon, all the way up to Lebanon. El Mul HaLevanon means all the way up to Lebanon. So we're talking about the kings west of the Yarden, Har, Shvela, Chof, up to Lebanon. So essentially, all of the kings in this whole region, otherwise known as Eretz Knaad, a land indigenously populated by Chiti, Emori, Knaani, Prizi, Chivi, Yevusi, a whole series of nations who populate this region. Generally speaking, you can identify different cities belonging to different nations or ethnic groups, and we'll talk about that shortly. as an overall title, the Eretz Canaan. We talk about these as Amei Canaan, the nations of Canaan, but Canaan was really one of them, probably the largest of them, but really one of them. We also divide between the Amorites and the Canaanites. Amorites being a generic name for those nations that live in the mountain region, and the Canaanites who live in the plain or the coast. But if you get even more specific, city by city, you can divide between Chiti, Chivi, Yevusi, Girgashi, Amori, Canaani, Prizi, etc.
There are no Plishtim yet there?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Are there Plishtim? There probably aren't Plishtim as a force to contend with at this point. Certainly the Plishtim that we know of in Sefer Shoftim and then Sefer Shmuel come into the picture during the period of Sefer Shoftim. It's not clear that they arrive during that period of time or that they're just beginning to emerge as a force. The Eretz Plishtim and the Plishtim of the days of Avraham are completely different population. They're probably called Plishtim only because we know the land in the area as Eretz Plishtim, and so the name stuck in hindsight. But they are completely different ethnic and...
There's some theory that the Plishtim are actually people that came over on boats.
That's not a theory, it's a fact. They come from Eretz, they come from the islands of Crete. They are the Poshe Crete, as it's called in the Navi. The people who came over from Crete, which is... that's exactly the group.
The Shoftim.
That's right. They come during the period of Shoftim, settle here. But there's an indigenous population there already from the days of Avraham. We call them Plishtim just because that became known as Eretz Plishtim. So they, so that's where the name stuck. So in the meantime, Vayhi kishmoa kol ha-melachim, all of these kings are hearing. What are they hearing? What are they hearing? It's a half a sentence. ויהי כשמוע כל המלכים אשר בעבר הירדן בהר בשפלה בכל חוף הים הגדול אל מול הלבנון החיתי האמורי הכנעני הפיזי החיבי והיבוסי. And all of these people heard. What did they hear?
About the conquest,
Yericho, Ai, Shechem. I don't know what they heard. There's a lot of things to hear about.
Did they hear
blessings and curses, depending on when those blessings and curses took place? Remember, if they happened in chapter 24, it's out of sequence. Did they hear about Yericho? Did they hear about Ai? And of course, it makes a big difference if they heard about Yericho or they heard about Ai.
Did they hear all of it, only parts of it also?
Right. If they heard about Yericho, it has one message. If they heard about Ai, it has a different message. If they heard about the Yarden, it has a third message. What exactly did they hear? It's unclear, but it's the second time, by the way, the expression Vayichi Shmoa is used. We had it back in chapter 5 as well, right after the splitting of the sea, the splitting of the Yarden, beginning of chapter 5. Vayichi Shmoa chol malchei ha-emori asher be'eber ha-yarden yama, v'chol malchei ha-knani asher al ha-yam, et asher hovish Hashem et me ha-yarden mipnei b'nei Yisrael ad Avram, v'yimas l'vavam v'lo yabam od ruach mipnei b'nei Yisrael. When all of the Canaanite kings and the kings of the Amorites living east west of the Yarden against the sea, and all of the kings of Canaan heard about the drying of the Yarden, so they got frightened. It's almost the exact same verse and verse structure. Second time, Vayichi Shmoa. What are they hearing? They're hearing something which motivates them to respond, and their response in Pasuk Bet is Vayitkabtsu Yachdav Lilachem im Yehoshua v'im Yisrael pe'echad. That whatever they heard motivates them to gather together, to unite in order to fight against Israel and against Yehoshua united.
And this is exactly what Yehoshua wanted to not happen, right?
This is Yehoshua's greatest fear. Yeshua's greatest fear is the unification of the city-states of Canaan into some kind of organized fighting force. And here we see Yeshua's fear begin to be realized. This is what he's concerned about. And something they hear, doesn't tell me what they hear. It just tells me that whatever it is they hear
has begun to materialize, and we are and we have to respond to it. We'll see what that response is. But the nations of Canaan have begun to coalesce. The kings of Canaan have begun to coalesce into a united group. What that unity will bring is essentially the stories of chapter 10 and 9, 10, and 11. 9 is a kind of a parenthetical piece, the breed, the covenant between Israel and the Givonim, which is what we're about to begin to look at. Chapter 10 is, take a look structurally. Beginning of chapter 10, right, same phrase again. Beginning of chapter 10, Vayichi Shmoa Adoni Tzedek, Melech Yerushalayim, Ki Lachad Yeshua Et Ha'ai, when Adoni Tzedek, king of Yerushalayim, heard that Yeshua conquered the city of Ai, Vayachriman, he destroyed it, Kasher Asal Yericho L'Malkah, as he had done to Yericho and its king, Ken Asal Ai L'Malkah, V'chi Yishlimu Yoshvei Givonot Yisrael V'yibri Kibam, and they heard that the Givonim made peace with Israel, which is a chapter we just skipped, we're going to come back to in a second. They were very fearful, and in pasuk gimel, vayishlach Adoni Tzedek Melech Yerushalayim el ha'am Melech Hebron ve'el Piram Melech Yarmut ve'el Yafia Melech Lachish ve'el Tvia Melech Eglon, sends to all of his neighboring cities and says, "Come, let's fight together. Let's do this once and for all." Again, there's that attempt to unify, to coalesce, to come together in order to fight the threat of Israel. That's in the south. That's Yerushalayim and the cities south of Yerushalayim down to Hebron. Chapter 10, chapter 11. When Yavin Melech Chatzor heard all that had so far transpired, Vayishlach el Yavav Melech Madon, ve'el Melech Shimron, ve'el Melech Achshaf, ve'el Melechim Hashem Mitzafon, Bahar u'Ba'arava, Negev Kinrot u'Bashvela, u'Benefot Dor Miyam, he sent a message to all of the kings in the area of Shimron, Achshaf, in the north, in the mountain, Arava in the plain, in the south of the Kinneret, Negev Kinrot, Ubenafot Dor, in the coastal city of Dor, Chatzor, Kinneret, Dor. We're up here. What were we down here? Chapter 10 is the war in the south. Chapter 11 is the war in the north. Now all the kings in the north heard about what's been transpiring, and guess what? They said together, Vayetzu, Pasuk Dalet, Vayitzu Hem B'chol Machanehem Imam Am Rav K'chol Asher Al Sfatayam. They gathered together a large nation, a large king, army, a large force. When you combine the city, the armies of five different cities of five different nations, then Taki, you have a significant fighting force. So Yoshua's fear of the unification of the kings of Canaan and the combined armed forces that they and threat that they would create is a very real fear. And it's strategically, it's exactly what the Canaanites realize is their only hope. And how Yeshua addresses that attempt at unity within the Canaanites, we will see as we learn through those parts. But you already see a pattern emerging for this whole second half of the story of the conquest of Canaan, each one starting with the phrase, Vayihi Kishmoa. Vayihi Kishmoa is almost this catchphrase that structures the whole first half of Sefer Yoshua. Vayihi Kishmoa, immediately after the split of the Yarden, Vayihi Kishmoa, and they heard, and they were fearful. From post-Ai, four chapters begin, chapter 9, 10, and 11, three chapters, each begin with the expression Vayihi Kishmoa, although the response is very different than it was back in chapter 5. It's not Vayihi Kishmoa, and they were fearful, it's Vayihi Kishmoa, and they respond. How they respond is different. The Givonim respond one way by trying to make peace with Israel, and the Canaanites and the Chivites and the rest of the nation responds. The rest of the nations respond by trying to organize and unify in order to wage war against Israel. That's the bird's eye view, if you will, of what's going on. There's a source page. We'll just hand it out. Do you have a copy of it?
Yeah.
One of the things that I put on the source page at the top, besides saying misprint, so you'll excuse me, that's in the title of the page, but that's for another time, is a little chart. And what this chart is a list of topics that is addressed in the opening 12 chapters of Sefer Yehoshua. We have now gone through 8 of them. We're starting chapter 9. And I thought it would be an interesting exercise to kind of take a step back and look at what Sefer Yehoshua looks like. The whole book. Because it's actually very structured, even though we've been going from episode to episode. When you take a step back and you see, it's actually very structured. There are 24 chapters in Sefer Yehoshua. The book itself as a whole divides neatly in half. And the transition between part 1 and part 2 is a very neat transition, namely chapter 12, right in the middle. Chapter 12 divides the Sefer completely. Why? Because chapter 12, if you look at it, I think you have to read it, just look at it. You see what chapter 12 is? Chapter 12 is Shira. Chapter 12 is written as a Shira. It's written like Hazinu. It's written in a kind of format, left and right, two columns. It's a song of victory, thanksgiving for the conquest of the 31 kings of Canaan. So, if you're already singing a song of victory for the conquest of the 31 kings of Canaan, then what essentially am I what plateau or what point have I reached? Right? I've conquered Canaan. I've essentially completed the conquest of Canaan. I'll call that Kibush Haaretz, the conquest of the land. So the beginning of the Sefer from chapter 1 through chapter 12 is the conquest of the land, Kibush Haaretz, which culminates in this Shiratayam, in the Shira of the Shirat HaMelechim. Chapter 13 begins, if you just take a quick look at it, V'Yoshua Zaken Ba Bayamim. Yeshua's old. If Yeshua's old already, that sounds like the end of the story. It's the end of the book. It's like, okay, Yeshua's life is over. Yeshua came in to lead the people into the conquest of Canaan, and we have this great song of victory, almost as if the book is the book has been completed, his task, his mission has been completed. V'Yoshua Zaken Ba Bayamim. And Yeshua is old. It's the end of his life. He's ready to retire. It's over. It's done. He's completed his task. We still have 12 more chapters. But Yeshua is finished. Vayomer Hashem elav, ata zakanta bata b'yamim. You are old. V'ha'aretz nishara harbe me'od l'rishta. But the land is still significantly unconquered or unsettled. And the rest of the story of Sefer Yehoshua from chapter 13 till the end is a division of the territorial areas of the land of Israel by tribe and the mandate to each tribe to go and settle its territory. Now, to settle its territory requires further military action, but the difference between the military action in the rest of the Sefer is that each tribe is on their own. Shevet Yehuda is sent into the territory of Shevet Yehuda to settle, to be there, and if need be, defend themselves, perhaps to conquer, perhaps to just protect themselves, but they are now mandated with taking the area and settling the area of the south. Up until chapter 12, the camp of Israel is in Gilgal. From chapter 13 and on, they break camp. And they send the tribes on their way. And between chapter 13 and chapter 24 is a mission, tribe by tribe. They will throw the goral, the lots to determine which tribe goes where. They will tell you what the geographic boundaries are of each tribe, where they have to settle, who was successful in settling the land, who was unsuccessful in settling the land. Everything from chapter 13 till the end could say through to chapter 24. It's not exactly correct. It's actually through till chapter 19. 20 to 24 is sort of a postscript to the story.
So even though they had conquered it already, it wasn't like it was so easy to settle it.
Correct. It's the difference between strategic control and settling the land.
Because the indigenous population was still there.
If I had to put a equivalent so we understand it, it's the difference between 1948 and everything that's happened since. The military conquest of the land of Israel was essentially 1948. Yeshua comes in to deal with the existential threat of the military powers that are there and take military and political control of the land. But you've got Israel is camped here, and the rest of the population is there. A handful have left, but for the most part, they're everywhere. So the next step is to go and settle in the tribal territory that belongs to Yehuda or Benjamin or Ephraim or Manasseh, and that's to contend with the local population and to settle on populated areas and to deal with the challenges that they create. And Geneva Conventions notwithstanding, settlements, etc. You put it into modern terms, I think it's very clear to understand that just because you've conquered the land militarily doesn't mean the story's over. There's still a long way to go before we can talk about the land of Israel being settled by the Jewish people or by the Israelites. So that's Yerushata Aretz. That's the process of going and dividing the land by Yerusha, by tribe, and the inheritance, and then settling the land. Kibush, the conquest, Yerushat Aretz, which, or Nachala, although is known as Nachala. According to Chazal, each takes 7 years. There is such a tradition, we'll talk about the chronology a little bit later. But you understand the division. Chapter 12 is that transitional point. This was Yehoshua's mandate. Yeshua was a general of the united army of Israel. Once that's done, every tribe is now on their own, led by their local military leaders and political leaders, Nisim, Shoftim, however you want to call them. Yeshua's role essentially is over. So he'll be their chief advisor. He'll sit back in the office and offer counsel. But their role as a military leader is for each tribe is on their own. They break up the army. They break up camp. So chapter 13 to 19 is very different than chapters 1 through 12. You understand? That's why and by the way, in the curriculum of Sefer Yehoshua, in almost all the schools, when they teach Yehoshua, they only teach up through chapter 12. Nobody ever gets past chapter 12 because it's just a list of names and cities. It's who is where. And we are going to run through it. We're going to do pieces of it. We're not going to do all of it. But that's the division of the Sefer. Then chapters 20 through 24 is your cleanup. What I mean by your cleanup, dealing with the 2.5 tribes, giving them released from the army, their release papers. Excuse me? Yeah, they get their discharge papers. You served your time, 14 years, now go back to your wives and children on the other side of the Yarden. Deals with the establishment of the cities of refuge, the Erei Miklat, and then the reenactment of the story of Shechem. So I've got 4 chapters of what I call cleanup.
What's the reenactment of
the story? Well, the story of Shechem either happens once or twice, depending on, right? So we're back to Shechem or the back to a Brit, and it's either the same elaboration of what happened in chapter 8 or it's a new version of it.
Back to like the original Shechem story of Yaakov. Why would they reenact that?
No, Shechem chapter 8, Shechem chapter 20. And that's the structure of the Sefer. Now, within this first part, which has been our focus for the last year and a half and will be primarily our focus till the end of the year,
within this section, it itself divides into two.
And that's what I've tried to show you in this chart. Essentially, everything leading up to the ceremony at Shechem, and then the rest of the story.
So what you have in chapters 1, let's do this.
Let's condense this a little bit.
All right. Chapter 1, you have your introduction. Chapter 2 is your spies. Chapter 3 and is
3 and 4.
3 and 4 is the crossing of the Jordan. 5 is the Brit Mila and the Korban Pesach. 6 is the Battle of Jericho. 7 and 8 is the success and the failure and success of Ai, and the second part of 8 is Shechem. That's one trajectory. When we crossed over the Jordan, our goal was to get to Shechem. We needed to get to Jericho to set up camp. I got stuck in there in the middle somehow, somewhere. I don't think I was part of the plan. We talked about that. But from here, we're essentially gone in to get to Shechem, to the blessings and curses. And then from there, once that ceremony has finished, once we've enacted that ceremony of Brachot V'Kalot and the Brit in the land of Israel, we are ready for the conquest to begin. Up until now, Yeshua has done very little to establish military control over the land. That hasn't happened yet. He's taken one city called Jericho and by accident took a second city called Ai. He's marched up to Shechem and he's going to come back to Gilgal. What happens now? What happens now is one story after another that now you begin to feel the conquest of Canaan. Chapter 9is the Brit with the Givonim. 10 is the war with the southern kings. 11 is the war with the northern kings. And 12, we're done. That's the conquest of Canaan.
So what was left in that they didn't do?
They conquered it militarily. They haven't settled it.
So it's not like there were pockets. I mean, weren't there places that needed still to be conquered? Like,
because there were Canaanites there, and they have to settle the land. They have to place the Jewish people in the different lands. And if you look at this map, all the orange is essentially where Israel went and settled, and all the yellow is where Israel never went and settled. So yeah, there's a lot. But we'll get that. Which is, you know, it's the irony because this map is the reverse of the modern map of Israel. Right? If I were to show you this map today, if you knew nothing about this, I would show you this map, what would you tell me? Right? There's your West Bank. Here's your Israel. This is your West Bank and your Jordan. And you would say the yellow is Israelite and the orange is Philistine or Palestine or Palestinian. In modern, in biblical terms, it's exactly reversed. This is your Israelite settlement and this is your Canaanite settlement and your Plishti settlement. Because this is essentially where we were and where we stayed, in the mountains. We never got to the coast. Why we never got down to the coast, we'll talk about that. That's a major issue. It's a military issue. To do with defense issues. But we settled the mountains for the most part. And the Canaanites stayed on the coast and in the valleys.
Okay. I had one other issue that I wanted to point out, and I'm not sure how much of this we're going to do now, but just as an observation, Yeshua's sequence is
to come into Israel, he heads first to Shechem, then he heads south to the area of Yerushalayim and Hebron, and then north into the area essentially of the Shomron, the Gilboa, Kinneret, Beit Shan. But if I look at the three major places where he goes to, Ai, Beit El and Ai, right, that's his first point first stopover. Shechem, his second stopover. And Yerushalayim and Hebron, more Hebron than Yerushalayim, as his third. And I look at the sequence. Beit El or Ai, Shechem, Hebron. Not necessarily in that order, but those three places, what stands out? What stands out? Anything? Whose steps?
He retraces his own steps because he went up.
Yeah, he's always going back to Gilgal. The camp is Gilgal. He goes to Ai, comes back to Gilgal. Goes to Shechem, comes back to Gilgal. Goes south, comes back to Gilgal. He's constantly going back to Gilgal. These are three different battles. He's not going from one to the other. He comes back to Gilgal at every stage of the game. But on a much more global scale, what's significant about these three places on the map? Right, they are essentially the places where Abraham comes to when he comes into the land of Israel. Abraham starts in Shechem, goes down to Beit El or to Ai, and then from there heads down to Hebron. They are the same places that Yaakov comes to when he comes into the land of Israel. He comes to Shechem after his meeting with Lavan, goes to Beit El where he has his Mizbeach, and then he goes to his father in Hebron. The sequence here is not an accident. The order is irrelevant. But the identification of these three places as of the key jumping points for the conquest of Canaan brings me back into the world of to the Avot and to the promise that wherever the Avot went, that's where his children would go. And you see the historical context repeating itself. Whether Yeshua had that in mind when he starts his process or not, I don't know. Strategically, Yeshua is looking at this from a very simple strategic vantage point, which is, here's your land, what's the best way to conquer it? Again, concerned if his primary concern is the unity of the nations of Canaan, what's the simplest strategic approach?
Separate.
Divide and conquer. So first, you cross the Jordan and you divide east from west. Then you cut across to Ai and you divide north-south. And you take from Ai to Shechem and you create a region from which you control. Then you head south into the area of Yerushalayim and Hebron, and then straight north into the area of the Shomron. And divide east-west, north-south, essentially break up the geographic areas of Canaan. Whereas if you start from the south and just head straight north, you've got to deal with the entire Canaanite army stage by stage. And if the entire country is before you and you march in like we did in Lebanon, so what's going to come meet you in your face? Everything. Right? Whereas if you walk in not from the front, but from the middle and the sides and the bottom, and as we did in Gaza. We didn't walk into Gaza from the north. We kind of walked into Gaza from everywhere. And then you divide up the territory and you prevent the enemy from being able to move reinforcements from place to place. It was a simple military strategy. Yeshua, who doesn't have a military strategy textbook from which to read, right? But Yeshua understands that he's coming in from Gilgal or Yericho, which Chazal called the key to Eretz Yisrael, Aklida de Eretz Yisrael. It's the key because if you understand it, Israel is if you're looking at Eretz Yisrael this way, and you're sitting here, and you understand the best the strategy has to be, it's much harder, right? It's much harder because you have many more fronts to deal with. But militarily, it's a much smarter move, which is to cut across and then through the middle, up and down. So I don't know if Yeshua is thinking about Shechem, Ai, Beit El, Hebron, Avraham, Yaakov, but that's the duality in which Tanakh operates. The real, simple strategy, earthly connotations and implications, and then the Rabbanu Shlom's cheshbon of how he runs the world. And that's essentially where we're at. That's my introduction to Perek Tet. Now we can learn the Perek. So we are beginning this second half of your the second part of the first half of the Sefer. Part 1B. And this is what we have focused on till now. Story of the spies crossing the yard in Pesach and Mila Yericho, Aishem. Very philosophical. Now we're going to get very... Now we get into the nitty-gritty of the relationships, the international relations of Yeshua and his neighbors. Pasuk Gimel. Pasuk Aleph and Bet, the Canaanites are gathering for war. Right? Vayitkabtzu yachtav lilachem im Yeshua im Yisrael pe'achad. The Canaanites are gathering for war. The clouds of war are gathering. The drum beats are rolling. You can hear it. And then, v'yoshvei Giv'on shamu et kol asher asah Yehoshua liyiricho la'ai. Amidst all of the various nations and Canaanites preparing for war, we're going to focus, zero in on one in particular, the people of Giv'on, who also heard that which God and Yeshua, that which Yeshua did to Yericho and to Ai. They also heard of the conquest. They heard the same thing that the rest of the Canaanites heard, but their response was, of course, different. You know the story of the Givonim. Yes? No? You know, familiar with the story of the Givonim? Oh, okay. Then I think we have to read through the story first. I assumed that you had some idea of... Okay, well, let's read through the story from beginning to end, and then we'll discuss it post. Ve'asu gam hema be'orma. So they too acted with guile. What the two is, who the gam is, we'll come back to later. But they needed to conduct themselves with some kind of deceit or guile for the reasons which will become clear. Vayelchu. First of all, where do they live? The Givoni in the land of Eretz. The Givon is right here. Can you see it on the map? Right in the middle. Yerushalayim is here. Northwest of Yerushalayim is the area of Givon. Today is an Arab village there called El Jib. Givon, El Jib. It's right near Telsta. Been to Telsta? Right. That's the area of the Givonim. So they're northwest of Yerushalayim. They're in the hills. They're in the mountains. They're a neighbor. Vayikru vayitztayaru. What does vayitztayaru mean? It's an interesting word. How do they translate vayitztayaru?
Disguise themselves.
Act
cunningly.
Act cunningly is v'orma vayikru vayitztayaru. Cunningly disguise themselves. All right.
Vayikru sakim balim lachamorehem. They took sackcloth for the donkeys. So they took garments, or they took, let's say, saddles, but they didn't take new saddles. They took saddles that were worn through. Vinodot yayin balim. They took wine casks or wine bottles that had holes in them. Umavukaim umitzorarim. That they were full of holes and full of old sediment. Un alot balot. And they put on shoes that were worn through. They put on shoes with holes in them. Un metulaot beraglehem. Uslamot balot alehem. They took salmaz, simlaz, clothes. They wore clothes that were worn through and had holes in them. Bechol lechem tzedam yavesh hayanu kudim. And they took bread that was old and moldy. Yeah. Why do they do all of that?
They say dry and toasted.
Right? What are they trying to convey?
They're not
No.
They're trying to pretend that they're not from Israel, that they came
right.
from outside of Israel.
Right. They're trying to pretend. This is their disguise. They put on clothes that were all worn through, and they took water bottles that had holes in them because they're made out of material. And in other words, everything that they did, they presented themselves as if they had just traveled for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Right. Right. It's the same group. That's the same group. The same, the Givonim, the results
That's
of the Givonim.
Right.
There you go. Excellent. So now you're going to learn the first part of the story. You've already learned the end of the story. We're going to learn the first part of the story. Excellent. Okay. That's called doing it backwards, but that's okay. Because Torah is a circle. Right? It doesn't make a difference where you start. You always end up in one of the same places. Vayachua Yehoshua al Machaneh HaGilgal. And they come to Yehoshua in the camp of Gilgal, which means they came from Givon to Gilgal. You know how long it takes to walk from Givon to Gilgal? From Givon to Gilgal?
It's not that far.
No, it's not that far at all. It's half a day journey. You don't wear out your shoes in half a day journey. But their point was they wanted to prove that they came from
somewhere else.
Up there in northern Turkey. Or out there in, you know, Iraq or Iran or Saudi Arabia or somewhere else. They said to Yehoshua in Gilgal, the El Ish Israel, and to the people of Israel, or to the representative body of Israel, and they said the following: Me'eretz ruchoka banu, we have come from a faraway land. Ve'ata kirtu lanu brit, now make a peace covenant with us. What's the reason why they had to disguise themselves as if they came from a faraway land? Why do they have to disguise themselves as if they came from a faraway land? Why couldn't they just show up and say, hey, we're the Givonim, we're your next door neighbors, make a brit with us, make peace with us?
So it wouldn't look like they were just coming to fight.
They don't look like anything. I don't know. So you can be your next door neighbor, we hang up a white flag and say, we want to make a brit.
They had that option. I mean, all the nations had options.
Oh, so that's the question, whether they had that option or thought they had that option, or didn't know that. Right? That's part of the question. But there is a distinction between the way the Torah deals with the seven nations of Canaan, the indigenous population, versus how it deals with faraway nations. If I didn't know anything about the Torah, all I knew was Yehoshua and Yericho were coming in to conquer the territory here. Yehoshua and Bnei Israel are coming in to conquer the territory here. I knew that I'm a threat. If I live here, I'm a threat, or I'm threatened. Because Yeshua is coming to conquer here. If I live here, I don't threaten.
But then why am I coming all the way down there to have a breed?
Because I want to have a breed. Because I want to recognize your nation and you recognize my nation. And why does, NATO have alliances between the United States and who knows who out in Yehupitzville? Because
globalization.
Right? Globalization. Because we want to be one big, happy, global national family, and I'll protect you and you protect me. What's a brit? A brit essentially is an alliance. It says that if I'm threatened, you'll come to my aid, and if you're threatened, I'll come to your aid. That's what a brit is, and we'll see. That's exactly what they do. The moment they become threatened, they call up Israel and say, hey, you made a brit, now come help us. Right? That's exactly. And Israel will go to war to defend them.
But they made the impression that they were coming from far away, that actually they were coming. Yehoshua figured out that they were just next door neighbors. What did he?
So let's see. That will become clear at the end of the parak. Right? So then it becomes a question whether the brit is binding. Then we'll get to all those things at the end of the parak. But at least I understand why they're coming disguised, because at least from their perspective, they believe that anybody in this territory is threatened, is in danger. And if they can prove that they come from a faraway land, then they're not in danger. They'll make the breach. They'll have a piece of paper. And when Israel's army shows up to say, hey, we're going to fight you, they can bring up the breach and say, how can you fight me? You made a covenant. I approve. So It's all on the piece of paper. Pasuk.
And Yehoshua would not have known that city was there.
Well, let's see what they know and what they don't know. Let's see. Vayachu Yehoshua l'machaneh ha'gagal v'yemu la v'alish Yisrael me'eretz v'chalka banu. We have come from a faraway land. Yatak yibtu lanu brit. Vayomer ish Yisrael el achivi. So ish Yisrael said to the chivi. Now, that's the first and most important reference to their ethnic origin. These people are of the nations of Canaan. Chiti, Chivi, Prizi, Yavusi, Girgashi, Canaani, Emori. They are of the people of Chivi. Why that's significant, we will see. So the Ish Yisrael said to the Chivi, Ulai bekirbi eta yoshev? Wait a second, I don't trust you. Maybe you're close. And if you're close, then I can't make a breach with you because I'm not allowed to make a breach with the nations of Canaan. It says so in the Torah, Lot tichot lahem breach, v'lot tichanem. Not allowed to make a breach with the Canaanites. Vayomru el Yehoshua. So they answered and said to Yehoshua, Avadecha nachnu, we are your servants. Vayomer alehem Yehoshua, mi atem u'mi'ayin tavo. Who are you, and where do you come from? Vayemu elav, they said to him, Me'eretz v'choka me'od ba'o avadecha. We have come from a faraway land, we who are your servants. L'shem Hashem Elokecha. We have come in the name of your God. Ki shamanu shamov et kol asher asa b'mitzrayim. Because we have heard all that he has done in Egypt. All that he did to the two Canaanite kings and Amorite kings on the other side of the yard, and Sichon Melech Hashbon, Ula Og Melech Habashan, Ashabashtavot, we heard how he destroyed Sichon and he destroyed Og, this powerful God of yours is unconquerable. Vayamu Eleinu, Skeinenu, our elders, these are the Givonim still talking, our elders said to us, V'chol Yoshve Arzenu, said to the inhabitants of our land out there in Givon land, Givon stand, take food with you for the journey and go and meet these Israelites. Go say that we are your servants, so that now make a brit with us. Now to prove their story, Zelachmenu Cham Hitztayadnu Oto Bimbatenu. Hitztayed actually means to take provisions. Right, so the word Seda. So with all of this was our bread, which we took as provisions for our trip. Biyom tzeteinu lalechet alechem, the day we left to come and meet you. V'yata hine yavesh v'yanu kudim, and look how dry and moldy it is. They're proving how far they came. Toasted? No, it's not toasted. It's dry. It's oh, art school translations. It's dry and it's moldy, and it's. These wine skins, that's a good translation, these wine skins that were brand new and now they are full of holes. Our clothing, our shoes, they've worn through from the length of this great journey that we have come from a faraway land called Never Never Land, or we used to call it somewhere between Lahaya Vilay Nivra. You ever hear that expression? No? Lahaya Vilay Nivra?
It's a very different place. The old Yiddishisms about colorful language. Place known as once upon a time in a faraway land. The land of
Lahayav Ulay Nivra. It's called Lahayav Ulay Nivra. Right next to the city called Lahadam, which is the acronym for Lo Hayu Dvarim Me'olam. Never was. It's a Talmudic expression, Lo Hayu Dvarim Me'olam, which is written as an acronym of Lahadam. So in the land of Lo Hayu V'Lo Nivra, it's essentially the same, the English expression of Yehupitzville, or although I think Yehupitzville is actually a real place, but nonetheless, that's where we come from. They saw the writing on the wall. Not hard to figure it out. They saw Kriyat Yamsuf, they saw Kriyat Yarden, they saw Yericho, they saw Ai. Everybody else going to go to war. Okay, take your pick. You go to war, or you can try to make a peace. You can either survive or be destroyed. Your choice is yours. Pasuk Yud Dalet. Vayikhu ha'anashim mitzedam. The people of Israel took of their provisions. They sat and they ate, broke bread with them. Old, moldy bread, nonetheless, notwithstanding, but they sat with them and they ate with them, which is, of course, a significant act in and of itself, a symbolic act. Vet pi Hashem lo shal. But they didn't ask God. They did it. They didn't ask God's advice. They have the Urim V'Tumim, they have the Kohen. They just did it. Vayas lahem Yehoshua shalom. Yeshua made a covenant of peace with them. Vayechot lahem brit l'chayotam, and he made a brit with them to leave them alive, not to destroy them. Vayishavu lahem nisye ha'ida. The elders of the congregation took an oath with them. Vayim mikseh shloshit yamim. 3 days later, they made the brit, they sent them on their way, they said he probably gave them fresh provisions for the journey back to Lo Hayu V'Lo Nivra, so they go all the way back to Lo Adam. And they heard that it took them all of half a day to get home, and they ended up in Givon, which is just over the next hill. And they dwell amongst them. V'yisu b'nei Yisrael. Israel got onto their jeeps and ran over the hills. Vayavo al arehem bayom ashlishi, and on the third day they came across their cities. Ve'arehem Givon v'kfirah u'beirot v'kiryat yarim, and look at their cities. Their cities were Givon and Kfirah and Beirot and Kiryat Yarim. Kiryat Yarim is Telstar. Okay, so what happened?
So why did it take 3 days?
Well, takes 3 days for all of Israel to go that which one person can do in half a day journey they can do.
Okay.
They're fuming. They're the blood is boiling. They get there, v'lo hikum b'nei Yisrael, and they did not destroy them. Now, if the Navi has to tell me v'loi kum b'nei so that they didn't hit them, they didn't destroy them, I can only assume that they wanted to, or that they deserved it, or that there was a reason that they could have or should have, perhaps. Right? They didn't. Why could they or should they have destroyed them? First of all, they're Canaanites. Second of all, they lied.
They
created a brit on false pretense. They cheated them. There's lots of reasons to. But they didn't. Why didn't they? Because the elders of Israel, the Nesiyei Ha'eda, had taken an oath by the gods, by God's name. You can't just violate an oath. So all of the people began to complain bitterly against the Nesiyim. Why were they complaining against the Nesiyim? Because the Nesiim took this oath, and if it wasn't for this oath, they would have been able to destroy the Givonim. But now, because of the oath of the Nesiim, they can't do anything to the Givonim, and they're all upset. So who are they upset at? לנשיאים. ויאמרו כל הנשיאים אל כל העדה. The Nisim said to the to the entire congregation, "Anachnu nishbanu lahem b'Hashem b'lokei Yisrael. We swore, we took an oath by the name of God of Israel. Atalonu chalun gobehem. We can't fight them." So you understand that there's a fight going on now, an internal fight, an internal dynamic between the Nisim and the elders and the people. They're all sitting and fighting and arguing amongst themselves as to whether or not they can. So claim the people. And the Nesim said, doesn't matter, we took an oath. And the people said, but it's on false pretense. And they said, but we took an oath. Well, who cares about the oath? Well, it was an oath of God's name. Who cares about the oath? How can you do that? We can go back and we can argue this thing in circles for 3 days. And that's exactly what they did. In the meantime, who's sitting on the sidelines and laughing? Zot naselem. So here's the Eitzah. This is what we'll do. You'll have to leave them alive. You can't destroy them. V'lo yalenu ketzef al ha-shvua she-nishbanu lahem, because if you destroy them, the God will be angry at us because of the violation of the oath we took with God's name. So this is what you have to do. You have to let them live in order that God should not be angry at us. V'yemu alehem ha-nisiyim yichyu. So the nisiyim said, they can live. However, but they will become the wood choppers and water drawers, right, of the entire congregation. Kasher dibru lahem ha-nesiyim. That's how the Nesiyim spoke to them. Vayikra lahem Yehoshua. Yehoshua called over the Givonim. Vayidaber lahem lemor. He said to them, Lama rimitem otanu? Why did you cheat us? Why did you lie to us? Lemor chokim anachnu mikem, all to say that we come from a faraway place. V'yatem b'kirbenu yashvim. You're our neighbors. Why did you lie to us? V'yata arurim atem. You will be cursed. And you'll be cursed because you cheated. Because you lied. V'lo yikaret mikem eved v'chotve etzim v'shoavei mayim levet alakai. You forever will remain chotve etzim v'shovei mayim to the house of God, to the temple. They were demeaning jobs. They were essentially making them like servants, housekeepers. V'yanu et Yehoshua v'yomru. So they answered Yehoshua. They said exactly why they cheated. It's very simple. Ki hugad, ki huged, hugad lavadecha. We did it because we heard that which God commanded Moshe, his servant, saying that he would give you the land of Israel and that you should destroy the local indigenous population. We heard that that's written in your Torah. We were frightened for ourselves. We were frightened for our lives. So we did this. Can you blame us? Called survival. Biyata inenu biyadecha. We are in your hands. Ketov v'chayesha b'enecha lasot lanu aseh. Whatever you feel is good in your eyes to do, do. We are at your disposal. We are at your mercy. Hayas lahem kein v'yatzel otam miyad b'nei Yisrael v'lo haragum. He did thus, and he saved them from the hands of Israel, and they did not kill them. Which gives you the impression. No, not Hashem here. This is Yeshua. V'yaslam ken v'yatzel otam miyad b'nei Yisrael v'la agum. He saved the Givonim from the hands of the Israelites and did not kill them.
They wanted to kill.
It sounds like there's a lynch mob out there.
Right.
That's just looking for blood. And the elders, and Yeshua in particular, had to act quickly and decisively and cleverly to avoid the execution of these givonim in the hands of Bnei Yisrael. Baknem Yeshua b'yom ahu chotve etzim v'shuave mayim. Yeshua made them chotve etzim and shuave mayim, woodcutters and water drawers, la'eda ulemizbeach Hashem, for the congregation and for the mizbeach, meaning the temple, ad ayom hazeh, till this very day, elamakom asher yivchar, to the place that God has chosen. We have a lot of work in this parak. A lot of issues in this parak. First of all, there's halachic issues. Were they right? Was it so that you could not make any kind of brit with the local indigenous population of Canaan? Were they therefore justified for their own survival in needing to come to them bi'orma, in deceit, or could there have been an alternative, and if so, what is it? Question number one. Question number two. What do you mean, gam hema bi'orma, they also acted deceitfully? Who's the also? The story began. Who is the reference to? They also acted deceitfully. Question number two. Question number three, and perhaps most importantly, how many different groups of leadership are identified in this perek amongst Bnei Yisrael? How many different institutions of leadership does this perek identify? Yeshua? Skenim? Nasim? Ish Yisrael? Eda? Bnei Yisrael? Question number four. Question number four. When the Givonim showed up and they're talking to Yeshua and they're talking to the elders and they're talking to... Right, they make an oath with them. It's a very strange episode. They make an oath with them. They make a shavua. They give them their story, and the people respond and say, we'll make an oath with you. Then they show up at the Givonim's doorstep, and they say, we want to kill you, and the Nisim come and say, but we can't. We took an oath. What do you mean? We just took an oath. They forgot they took an oath. They didn't forget they took an oath. They decided they took an oath, and they forgot about the oath. The dialogue in this story is completely convoluted and mixed up. So we're going to have to sort it out. And that's part of our agenda.
Wasn't it like, it seems like they did the Shavua without even really conferring with Hashem.
They took the Shavua without conferring with Hashem.
It seems like they, on their own, made this decision. That's
correct.
What rubs me the most when I read this.
Correct. Over. Very significant, serious issue. Pi Hashem lo sha'alu. Make the question number five. You can make a brit, you can make a pact, sure, you can make a covenant. It's valid. It's binding.
Valid.
Absolutely. Political alliances we made all the time. One nation to another.
I have the same question.
Oh.
But there's no mention of Shem anywhere in
this. Well, it says that they took an oath by Shem Elokei Yisrael.
By making that decision to do that,
it
like
says explicitly, it's Pi Hashem Lo Sha'alu.
Right.
They did not seek God's opinion in this matter. Not the first time, maybe it is the first time, but it's certainly not the last time. But it usually gets them into trouble.
Was this really the first time?
No, I would have to think that one through if they've ever acted without. But certainly not the last time.
It's a weird expression also that's used, I mean, it should be sort of pet achad, like with one mouth, and then you have pi hashem.
Interesting also, Pi Hashem Lo Sha'alu, they're Pi Achad. Interesting observation of use of terms. So we have our work cut out for us in the study of this story, Perek Tet, story of the Givonim.
Stay tuned.
We will stay tuned a couple of weeks, and then we will move on.